Pull up a chair, make yourself comfy, and let's talk guitars. Hi, this is Cams, your host, and welcome to another episode of Acoustic Guitar IO. Earlier in the year, I sat down with English luthier Adrian Lucas of Lucas Guitars, and we had a nice chat. So, without any further ado, I'd like to share that with you now. Hello, listeners, friends. Welcome to another episode of Acoustic Guitar IO. I'm Cams, your host. And this afternoon, I have the great pleasure of sitting with luthier musician Adrian Lucas. Hello, Adrian. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Cams.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Well, Adrian and I go back a reasonably long way, back to the RMMGA gatherings at Buxton. When our first one was 2005, so we probably met
it's about the time I first went, I think.
So Adrian's a regular at these gatherings, and it's lovely to see him back here with us again.
Lovely to be here.
You've just come back from Berlin, I believe.
Yeah.
What were you doing in Berlin?
Well, the Holy Grail guitar show, it was the fourth edition. I was exhibiting there. I've been to every show since it started, although the last show I wasn't exhibiting. They have a rotational principle for the exhibitors. The exhibitors don't exhibit year after year. So I did the first 2 years, and then the third show I was on the show team, helping to organise the show and volunteering. So the last show, I had a really good time just wandering around, talking to everybody, looking at the exhibits, which you can't do that when you're exhibiting because you're at the table.
Of course,
all the time.
Yeah.
So it was back to the grindstone this time.
But yeah.
Very good, very inspiring.
And what did you build for the show this year?
Well, three guitars I built specifically for the show. I have three sizes of acoustic guitar. The medium size is called the Arbor. I made an Arbor with a sweep cutaway in local woods. One of the features of the show is they have a local wood challenge where exhibitors are invited to build a guitar with woods from their particular locality. You know, whether that be in England or India or wherever.
Okay.
And I built a couple of guitars with that in mind. So I took this acoustic, which I made with some really nice figured cherry. And then I built a Redwood Pavilion, which is my largest model, with Sinker Redwood, and reclaimed Cuban mahogany back and sides.
Yeah, I just had a look at that. It's a very, very beautiful instrument.
With I used white holly for the bridge and fingerboard to contrast with the dark top. So it's kind of almost like a photographic negative of what you would expect to see.
It's a great look. It's a really great look.
And then I built... When I did the first Holy Grail show, I was absolutely knocked out with the electric guitars there. They have about 60% electric builders. And I had been completely unaware of the European electric guitar building scene.
Right.
And it's amazing, the kind of stuff people are building. And I've always played electric guitar, so I thought, right, I'm going to build something for the show. So I got on the computer and messed around with... I have all my guitars drawn on CAD. So I scaled the acoustic bodies I got down and played with it and came up with a design that I like the look of. And the whole concept behind the electric was that it would be semi-solid, essentially an acoustic body with a block down the middle to combat the feedback and make it have some characteristics of a solid guitar.
Yeah, and it's very light, it feels quite light.
And I used local woods for that. That's made of yew and bog oak, 5,000-year-old bog oak.
5,000-year-old, my goodness.
It's mind-boggling to think what the world was like when that tree was growing.
Yes. And you do build a lot with reclaimed woods as well, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, I rarely go to exotic woods as a default anymore.
Right.
I've got a big stash of old mahogany, which is you know, the bigger the stash gets, the more selective I can be about the wood. And I've got some very nice, very stable old mahogany, Honduras and Cuban.
So I think a couple of years ago you had one with mahogany from an old door, is that right? Or a door frame or something?
Yeah, I think I got some door frames that came from Bradford University.
Ah, okay.
When they were refitting the doors, and a joiner friend of mine was working on that job.
Uh-huh.
And phoned me up and said his mates were cutting them up for firewood. Did I want some?
Yeah.
And brought me a whole load, and that's made really good necks.
Wow.
Some of the most resonant mahogany I've come across.
And tell us about the piano that you turned into a guitar.
Well, I have here with me a small pergola guitar, which is my smallest size, more or less equivalent to a 00 Martin. Uh-huh. And I teach at Newark College one day a week. I teach on the guitar making course. And there are four courses there: piano, violin, guitar and woodwind, for making instrument making courses. And our technician Steve, he also looks after the piano guys, and the head of the piano school gave him this piano lid and said, could you cut this up into squares for the piano students to practice French polishing on? So he had a look at, he brought it to me, knowing that I'm a bit of a scrounger for such things. And we looked at it and decided it was actually a really nice piece of mahogany and didn't ought to be cut up for practicing French polishing. So he gave it to me and went and found some nice veneered plywood for the students to work on. So I've re-sawn that. I've actually got about three guitar sets out of it.
Right.
So I decided to build an all mahogany body with it. Mahogany top, back and sides from the same plank. So it's been making music. It's been resonating to music for a long, long time, that piece of wood.
Yeah, I love that idea.
I like to build guitars where there's a story behind the materials.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
It's
nice to kind of make these things live again.
Yeah.
Once they've passed their original purpose.
Yeah.
And really, that's the greenest. Using local woods is good, but you're still using trees that are cut down.
Yeah.
Whereas the reclaimed wood, it's something that is destined to be thrown away.
So, and of course, you have the advantage then of the woods already having dried out.
Exactly. It's very stable on the whole. It's done all the moving it's going to do.
Yeah.
And the actual chemical properties of the wood change over time. The resins crystallise and things like that. And
I can imagine what the bog oak must have been through then.
Yeah.
How thousands of years of lying at the bottom of a swamp.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, bog oak is usually black or brown, and that's due to, I think it's the iron in the water that turns it black.
Ah, okay.
So there's obviously some kind of mineralisation process going on.
Yeah.
But it does work just like regular wood. It's not, it's nowhere near fossilised or anything like that.
And you use bog oak in back and sides, or is it?
I have done, yes. And it is quite, it's becoming quite, I wouldn't say popular, but quite common.
Right.
Bog oak back and sides, there's a few people doing it now.
I know Sinker Redwood has quite a good reputation.
For similar reasons, I guess. Yeah. Sitting in the water for years, starved of oxygen, it kind of mineralises a bit.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. Now, two of the features of your guitars are the zero fret and the sound hole.
Mm.
What was your thoughts behind the zero fret, first of all? What does
that do? I first used the zero fret on a commission where I was asked to do it. And it just seemed to make so much sense. The open string is coming off a fret, the same as the fretted strings.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting the same kind of tonality. And for a maker, the setup is very simple because you're not cutting nut slots. There is a nut behind the zero fret, but that's simply a string spacer.
Right.
So I tend to make nut on zero fret guitars. I tend to make the nut out of wood, which kind of sits in with the rest of the guitar, because you don't need the bottom of the slot. Yes. It's just a sideways guide.
So the material of the nut has no relevance really to the tone.
It's immaterial, if you like.
Yes. And does it help with intonation to have a zero fret?
I don't think it makes any difference to the intonation. It's a single point of beginning for the string,
mm-hmm.
in the same way that a nut would be. So I don't think it really makes any difference.
Okay.
Sometimes people will compensate a nut, but I've even seen one maker, Nigel Forster. I've seen he did that with a zero fret, where he's moved the peak of the fret for each string.
Oh, really?
You're taking a wide fret,
uh-huh.
which is quite odd looking thing.
Did you ever build with fan frets? You ever done that?
Yeah, I have built. I've done a couple of fan fret guitars, and I'm actually, the next thing I'm going to build is a commission for a fan fret.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting, because the bridge is not square to the centre of the soundboard.
Yes.
And that's reflected in the bracing, which is kind of offset.
Okay.
Okay.
And they do look rather odd from a...
They do, yeah.
A viewer's perspective, but yeah. to play, they don't really feel all that different.
A lot of people will pick up a fan fret guitar and not notice.
Yeah, it's interesting.
If they don't know.
It's interesting. The geometry just fits.
Yeah, I think it's almost more ergonomic to have the frets at the nut end slanting away from you.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fits the hand shape well.
So it may be helpful for players with carpal tunnel or shoulder issues, anything like that.
I believe Rickenbacker made an electric guitar in the 60s, which wasn't fan fret, but all the frets were slanted. So okay. they were parallel, but slanted as they are at the lower end of a fan fret neck.
Yeah. And I know that you've used the Manzer wedge design on some of your instruments.
Mm. Yeah, that works. I think once you get to the sort of something deeper than anything like an OM, it's really helpful because it considerably reduces the depth of the side on the bass side of the guitar, where it fits under your arm. So you've not got that huge reach over a big, wide bit of body.
Just a bit more comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I often do that on the larger guitars just by default.
Okay. Now, some 2 years ago when I bought a guitar from you, we had a great discussion about the sound hole in the side of the guitar, and you explained it to me.
The sound port.
The sound port.
Yeah.
Could you explain a bit of that for our listeners about the advantages?
The sound port is a little extra hole in the side of the guitar, usually on the bass side, on the upper about.
Uh-huh.
And it does provide... I always feel the best place to hear a guitar is not from the position you play it in, but mm-hmm. from a couple of metres away in front of the guitar.
Sure, yeah.
Now, I think with the sound port, you get some of that frontal sound coming at you through the hole.
And does that detract from the sound that comes from the sound hole?
No, I mean, I think you have to treat the sound hole as the sound port as part of the sound hole.
Right.
The total area of sound hole will affect the air resonance inside the body.
Okay.
So if you add a sound port to a guitar that already has a regular size sound hole, it will raise the air resonance by about a semitone.
Right.
Well, the size I do it.
Yeah.
Which is around sort of 20 to 25 mil diameter. Mm.
So you can compensate for that by adjusting the size of the sound hole?
Yeah. I often reduce the sound hole size uh-huh. by an area equivalent to the sound port.
Interesting.
But if you want to deliberately raise the air resonance, you can do that with the sound port.
And would you adjust your bracing if someone were going to have a higher air resonance? Would that affect the bracing of the guitar?
Well, certainly a stiffer top will make for a higher resonance, higher air resonance.
Okay.
Because you have these different resonances. You have the top resonance, the air resonance, and the back resonance, and they all interact with each other. So you can affect one by tweaking another one.
And when you're selecting wood sets, is that something you take into account with tap testing?
Well, I think that's a bit more instinctive than analytical.
Right.
I'm kind of listening for a musical sound in the tap tone, and with a sort of reasonable integrity in the flex of the thing. And it's just something, I think, the more guitars you build, the more of a picture you get. You have to kind of, as you go on and build more and more guitars, you have to build up a correlation between the sound of the guitar and what you know you did in the construction and what the materials were like.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing to quantify, because every time someone comes up with a rule, someone will do the opposite and make a really successful instrument.
Yeah.
So I tend to think these days you have to kind of just absorb the experience and let your subconscious kind of process that over sort of several guitars. You start to build up a picture in your mind.
Sure.
And these days I don't try and analyze that too much. I just allow it to happen and trust my own feelings about things.
Well, it's art at the end of the day. It's a combination, I suppose, of art and science in a way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of science in there, but people who take a totally scientific approach don't necessarily make better guitars.
No, I've seen some tests done in labs where they're testing tonal frequencies using lab equipment. And
they can be quite... The results can be quite odd sometimes and quite contradictory.
Unexpected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if you introduce blind testing from the listener.
Yeah.
I was involved through the college, Newark College, where I teach. We were involved in a project called the Leonardo Guitar Research Project, where we built pairs of guitars. We got students to build pairs of guitars that were identical as possible in terms of design material, design, and one guitar in the pair would be made with tropical woods and one with non-tropical woods, and then so they were as close as we could make them, apart from
so
the
it's
materials.
Like a real A-B and test.
We had blind tests both for listeners and for players, and in the blind testing we asked them to state a preference for one or the other, and it was over a huge number of samples, it was 50-50.
Wow.
And then we did the same test without the blindfold, and hey presto, 70% in favour of the tropicals.
Interesting.
So there's a kind of visual... You know, when you take the visual away, people are hearing in a different... Or think they're hearing differently.
Well, people have... They've built up their idea based on internet research... Yeah.
But that kind of psychological aspect is so powerful in influencing what you think you hear.
Well, I'll just tell you a little bit about the guitar I bought from you when I first saw it. I always figured myself as I favoured the traditional, you know, the Martin design, rosewood, mahogany, maple. I didn't think I was into a modern style of guitar. This was the idea I had in my head. And as you know, I picked up that guitar and played one chord and was immediately smitten. And all my prejudice just disappeared, and I realised it was about tone. Tone is the most important thing in a guitar. Aesthetics are important, yes, but I think tone should be the primary goal.
Absolutely, yeah.
So if you have a customer looking for a commission, how do you narrow down what kind of thing would suit that particular customer?
What I usually do, if they're coming to my house, I'll ask them to bring along a guitar that they know well. Doesn't matter whether they like it or not. It's good if they're familiar with it. We can use that as a beginning point of reference that's measurable. And if they say, well, I like this guitar, but the neck's too wide, or the scale's too short, or the body's too deep, we've got things we can specifically measure and know sort of by what degree they need to be reduced or enlarged or whatever. And if they haven't got such a guitar, they can play one of mine and say, well, you know, go through a similar process.
Yeah. And do you find there are cases where the customer would have preconceived ideas of particular tonal qualities in certain tone woods that you have to maybe steer them away from?
I had that experience fairly recently where a customer came to me with a kind of pick list of all the woods that he was going to wanted on this guitar.
Mm.
And I showed him a few of my guitars, which, as you know, are often in not traditional guitar woods.
Yeah.
He says, oh, well, I really like this. Let's go for this wood. We went through that on several of the features of the guitar.
Yeah.
He sort of came round to, because I showed a guitar that was successful using these non-traditional woods, and he saw that I could use those woods in a way that he liked the sound of.
Yeah.
You know, it changed his idea of what... It's down to the preconception thing again, really.
I know, That can be powerful. It can be.
And certainly the sort of internet forums, there can be a lot of talk where people reinforce those prejudices with
I've
each other.
I've seen that a lot, I've possibly even participated in some of that.
So I kind of, although my guitars don't look traditional, to me I've arrived at them through a sort of logical path, rather than, I haven't gone out to design them as unusual or wacky or anything. I was trained, I studied architecture when I was young, and one of the phrases that was bandied about a lot was form follows function.
Oh, yes.
Where the aesthetics of something, buildings in that case, came directly out of the function. And that's really how I feel about guitar design.
Mm.
You should be able to look at the guitar and kind of, it should make sense.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean there isn't an aesthetic sense to it. You know, I always try and get an aesthetic hole to the guitar, but
Well, you have a very distinctive style. You can tell a Lucas guitar across a room of, well, like we have here this weekend. We have a room filled with a ridiculous number of guitars.
That's true.
Yeah. And you can pick the Lucas out from way across the room. It's a very distinctive style.
The other thing that is kind of, I don't know if it's unusual, but I started out building classical guitars. I learned guitar making originally through classical guitar making. So a lot of that kind of classical sensibility stayed with me, in that I didn't start from the standpoint of a Martin. I started with a classical guitar and adapted it to work for steel strings.
Yeah.
Hence I build with a Spanish heel, which I think makes for a lightweight guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I usually do a French polish finish. And I didn't kind of have that baggage, I suppose, of the steel string guitar world. I'd kind of... The first time I was asked to make a steel string guitar, I adapted what I knew about classical guitars.
Mm-hmm. And Spanish heel? What's the Spanish heel?
That means an integral... Rather than the neck and the body being two separate parts that are fitted together at the end via a dovetail or a tenon joint.
Yeah.
Spanish heel means when you build the neck, you build the part that's inside the guitar as well as outside. What would be the neck block in a guitar with a separate neck?
Mm-hmm.
And it has two slots in it, which the sides go into. So when you build the guitar, you're building face down on a board that is shaped to the shape of the soundboard.
Mm-hmm.
The soundboard goes on first, and it's all braced within this dish. The neck is glued onto that, and then the sides to that. And so all the alignments and angles of the neck are built in at the construction stage.
Okay.
So you're basically building the body around the neck and the soundboard.
And does that mean that later on the neck can't be adjusted without...
Well, it means it's very structural. There's a structural integrity to it in the first place. So I think it's less likely to have problems of twisting and stuff, because the top and bottom of the neck heel inside the body are... They're kind of elongated and glued to the top and back plates.
Right.
Which, to me, to my mind, makes for a great structural integrity. Mm. You can reset the neck by just releasing the back from the heel.
Right.
And then you can just change the neck angle and glue it back down.
Yeah.
It's fiddly, but it can be done. But I'm really trying to build guitars that don't distort in the way that would require a neck reset.
Well, you have the advantage there of having the reclaimed woods that have already settled
down.
That's
true, yeah.
And you use double sides?
Yes, as of for the last 3 or 4 years, I think, I've been laminating the sides from two pieces so that they are thicker than a single piece of wood side. Normally, in order to bend a side, you've got to thin it down to about 2 millimetres.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not going to bend. So what I do now, I'm making two sides, sort of inner and outer. So the outer one is the cosmetic one, and then there's an inner one. And they'll probably be somewhere between 1.5 and 1.8 millimetres each. So you're ending up with a thicker side at 3 and 3.5 mil thick. And what that does, it forms a rigid boundary to the soundboard.
Mm-hmm.
And this means the energy from the soundboard generated at the bridge is not lost into the sides flexing. It's kind of re-feeding back into the soundboard.
Yeah.
And I do find they're quite focused and punchy with that system.
Yes, I would agree.
So I'm doing that sort of by default now.
Okay.
It's a bit more work. You have to make a mould. You have to use a mould to laminate the sides. So you're going to make a different mould for every body shape. But once you've made it, you've got that mould. So it's a bit more work because you've got to do the lamination and clean it all up and everything. It's a bit messy, glued up with epoxy.
Right.
But messy's fine. It's like mud pies, really.
And besides building guitars, you're also a very keen musician.
Yeah, I play in a couple of blues bands. I played guitars since I was about 14.
Okay.
And almost entirely that time I've been a band player. I've never been a solo musician. I kind of grew up learning guitar with friends who also played guitar or drums or bass or whatever.
And did you start with acoustic?
Yeah, right at the very beginning. We had a family classical nylon string guitar. I'm not sure I'm allowed to call it a classical. It was a cheap Japanese thing. In the days when Japanese guitars were quite cheap and plywoody.
Aye.
But I got an electric guitar quite early on. An electric guitar is really a band instrument, whereas I think of acoustic more as a solo instrument.
Yeah.
And it's just a wonderful thing to do, I think, playing with other musicians and that kind of telepathy you get. The first time I remember my brother got a bass and I got a guitar, and we had a couple of friends used to come round and jam. And the first jam I ever had, I was just playing some chords and this guy sat down at the piano and said, "Keep going," and improvised for about 20 minutes, and it just blew my mind completely. I was kind of walking 2 foot off the ground for the next 2 weeks, and I still haven't quite come down. That was 45 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's why we do it. You can have some magical moments with music, certainly. That's one of the big attractions of coming to this gathering.
Yeah.
Some of the music and
there's always some crazy jamming, and the plucky dip is a great feature.
The plucky dip is a great feature indeed, yes.
Because it throws people together in a random way, and you have to find something musically in common with that whoever it might be.
Yeah.
And it could be somebody from a completely different field of music or style.
Indeed, yeah. Well, Adrian, it's been a great pleasure to sit and talk with you this afternoon.
Likewise.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you
for having me. If people want to find you online, can you send them somewhere they could find you?
Yeah, well, I have a website, which is www.lucasguitars.co.uk. And that's important, the .co.uk, because there is a lucasguitars.com in America.
Okay.
A guy called Randy Lucas. I'm not him. And I have a Facebook page, Adrian Lucas, and I have a Instagram account.
Okay, so you're quite easy to find in all the usual places.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Adrian, and I hope you all enjoyed listening, and we'll see you all on the next one. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Many thanks again to Adrian for sitting down with me and having a chat. It was great to talk to him and I learned a lot. As I talk to you now in the microphone, my Pavilion 12 fret sweep guitar is hanging above my desk, and I thank the guitar gods every day that I was able to bring that guitar home. I was so fortunate to find it. It inspires new things from me and it really is a good musical companion for me. You know how it is when you find the one. I'm not saying that that is the one, because as any guitar player will tell you, the one doesn't exist. The quest is ongoing. Guitar acquisition syndrome and all that. But I think I can safely say that this one is a keeper. I enjoy playing it a lot. I hope you enjoyed listening to that interview with Adrian. And if you're able to check him out, feel free. His website, as he said, is lucasguitars.co.uk. And he's on all the usual social media sites as well. I'm Cam's your host, and if you've enjoyed listening, please share this with your friends. If you have any ideas on future guests, players, luthiers, or anyone that you think would be a good fit for the show, please get in touch. You can get me on Cam's, that's C-A-M-S, at acousticguitar.io. I'm also publishing on the Steam blockchain, so you can find me there on steemit.com, that's steemit.com, / @acousticguitar. Thanks for listening.